Welcome to Bookin' It. Today's episode will be Kristen Lovren's Daughter. Hey everyone, and welcome back to Bookin' It. I'm your eloquent host, Cooper Cobbs, and today I'm doing a solo episode, but this time my microphone is plugged in, selected as the audio input, and we should be all good to go. Thank you so much for joining us, and in case you didn't get that reference, the past couple times that I've done an episode all by myself, my microphone was plugged in, but not selected as the audio input on my computer, and so it resulted in some subpar audio, but today I triple checked, and we should be good to go. And if it turns out that I was recording on my computer audio the whole time, I don't know what I'll do. But anyway, so glad you've joined us today. I'm talking about a book called Kristen Lovren's Daughter. But before I get there, I just want to say thank you guys so much just for listening, for supporting, for those who support, for sharing with your friends. These past couple weeks and these, you know, going next couple weeks are just going to be an incredibly busy climax to all of our high school careers, for myself, for Tanner, Bryce, and Isaiah. All of it is climaxing here, with prom, with speech and debate regionals, with preparing for graduation, thesis defense, all that kind of stuff. We've just been so busy, but God has been so good through all of it, and just making us more like his son and blessing us with a wonderful community of listeners and people who keep listening to these podcasts and being edified by them. We're so glad that you guys have decided to keep listening and sharing with your friends. It's just been a wonderful experience for all of us throughout high school. And now we are graduating. So, wow, it's exciting. But anyway, thank you so much. And thanks for hanging with us as we try to get some episodes out there for you, even as we are really busy. So, all right. So, Kristen Lovren's Daughter. Maybe you've never heard of this before. What is it? Why am I even talking about it? Well, I didn't know what it was until a couple months ago when a podcast I like called Classical Stuff You Should Know did an episode on the first book in the trilogy. So Kristen Lovren's Daughter is kind of like Lord of the Rings in the fact that it is one singular volume, but it's made up of three books. So The Wreath, The Wife, and The Cross are all comprise Kristen Lovren's Daughter. So it was mentioned by Classical Stuff You Should Know. They talked about the first book. They summarized it, discussed it. And then I found out that another podcast I like called Close Reads was reviewing it on their like supporter-only show. And so kind of recommended by two different trusted sources, and the fact that I needed a break from Wheel of Time on Audible, I downloaded it on Audible and started listening. So it took me almost a month. It's about, you know, it's a good 40 hours. Actually, probably close to 50 hours, honestly, on Audible. And it was just a wonderful time to listen to it when driving, when mowing the lawn, when doing whatever. And it was pretty, pretty awesome. So today, I want to be summarizing kind of a basic plot. I won't dive too deep into spoilers. And then I'll give my thoughts on it after that. So what exactly is Kristen Lovren's Daughter? So here, I need to put a bit of a warning here. It's going to be, so Kristen Lovren's Daughter is probably not for anyone under 16. Like, it's very wise, it's very, it's just wise. You know, it's not going to depict anything and affirm anything that's wrong. It's not going to be explicit in any grotesque ways. That said, it does handle some mature themes, and it handles them very well, but it is not for everyone. So my pitch is, Kristen Lovren's Daughter is like Scarlet Letter, if Scarlet Letter was easier to read, if you get the right translation, and it was actually better. and it was set in medieval Norway, above it all. So Kristen is a girl from Norway, and the book follows her life when she's like 7 until she dies when she's like 60. But like I said, it's Scarlet Letter. It deals with themes like adultery and dealing with consequences of sexual sin and things like that. So if you are under 16, probably don't check this book out, but I think it's a very wise book. I think it's a good book to read and just kind of discuss with your parents, with your family. Anyway, I'll just say, why do I call it Scarlet Letter if it was better, easier to read, and set in medieval Norway? Well, number one, the translation, note on that, it was written by originally an author named, not originally, it was written by an author called Sigrid Undset, and she was a Norwegian author. She wrote in the 1920s. This book came out in the early 1920s and actually won her the Nobel Prize for Literature. Anyway, so it's translated into English. There are two main translations. There's one that's older, and it has a lot of, I don't know, tries to, like, medievalify the text. So it has old-fashioned English words like I trow, whatever you call it. And they talk an old kind of form of English. The newer translation, the one I listen to, is the one that Penguin Classic uses. It's by a translator called Tina, or named Tina Nunnally. Tina Nunnally. And it's a lot easier, simpler to read, pretty straightforward. And so it's not anything like Hawthorne and the Scarlet Letter. But it is like Scarlet Letter in the fact that it deals with things like guilt and shame and sin and things like that. But also it's set in this completely transformative setting in medieval Norway. There's this wonderful world you can just enter into. And I'll talk about that later on in my thoughts. Anyway, so Kristen is Kristen Lavrens' daughter. So her dad is Lavrens, and she is called Kristen Lavrens' daughter because she is Lavrens' daughter. Wow, who thought? And her eventual husband, you know, is Erland Nicolau's son. So if you're a guy, you'd be your father's name and son. If you're a girl, you'd be your father's name and daughter. So pretty easy. As Close Reads keeps pointing out, Kristen Lavrens' daughter is a very important title because it signifies that Kristen is herself and her father's daughter at the same time. So it's very important for like kind of the themes of the story. But Lavrens is a wealthy farm owner, landowner in northern Norway. Not all the way north, but, you know, fairly north Norway. And so she kind of grows up on this farm. She's this lovely, beautiful, innocent child who just everybody loves and adores. And Lavrens just loves her. Lavrens is a great guy. He is jovial. He's wise. His wife, Rongfrid, is just kind of this distant, removed. She had several miscarriages. She has no sons because they all passed away when they were infants. So she's very removed and solemn throughout most of the book, although she has a very good story arc, a very good character arc, and she is a good character. So it follows Kristen, and she grows up on this farm. She's innocent, lovely. Everybody finds her beautiful. And eventually, when it comes time enough for her to marry, her father, Lavrens, engages her to this guy named Simon, or Seaman, if you are listening to the audiobook. And they translate these incredibly simple English names into, you know, the Norwegian pronunciation. So, Seaman is betrothed to Kristen, but because of plot reasons, Kristen has to go to Oslo, the capital, to spend some time in a convent with some nuns. And there she meets Erland Nicolausson, and he is this dashing, handsome lord who's been disgraced. He's a nobleman who's been disgraced because of some things that he's done that are not great, but she falls in love with him. They commit sin together, and eventually she's like, "Dad, I want to marry him and not Simon." And that's kind of where the first book takes place, is that kind of just sequence of events. And so it deals with, like I said, things like sin, marriage, family, guilt, forgiveness, God, all of it. And it's wonderful, it's beautiful. But what do I think about it besides the fact that it's wonderful and beautiful? Well, my one-sentence thesis or summary of this book is, it is a pinnacle of Christian imagination, okay? Pinnacle of Christian imagination. What do I mean by that? Well, first and foremost, it is just wise. It is thematically rich, it is morally sound, and it is wise when it comes to Christian storytelling, okay? So I think, you know, the classic example of Christian imagination would be Lord of the Rings. It's just this wonderful book that is fantasy, but at the same time, thoroughly Christian all the way through. This wonderful explosion of imagination and this wonder from a Christian author with the thematic richness and depth of just a solid foundation upon Christian doctrines, okay? This book is like that as well. It is imaginative. It is historical fiction that is completely immersive. So 14th century Norway just comes alive. You can see the conflict between, you know, the old paganism of the old Scandinavian way of life. You can see it conflicting with the medieval Catholic way of life, and it's the clash that happens with the people, with the politics. It's so completely immersive that you can get lost in it, and at the same time, trying to find your footing can get difficult. So it is wonderful in that sense, but it's Christian all the way through. And this is just a pinnacle of Christian art, and it just makes me long for having this kind of literature, and, you know, movies too, this kind of art, just in the Christian space. Like, Christians writing art like this that is wise, that is thematically rich, that isn't moralistic or just too simplistic at all. Like, it is just thoroughly Christian all the way through. You know, like, it deals with, like, priests are main characters. Like, they give long speeches about God and Christ. And this book takes God and Christ seriously as if they're realities that exist, and that forgiveness is something that is sought, and sin is something real. Takes all that seriously, and yet you can read this, and you can just sense that it's way different than pure flicks. You know what I mean? Like, it's just way different, and it is thematically rich, it is deep, and it's just completely wise and all the way through. So it's not, you know, like watching Fireproof, and you can find out about relationships from a Christian movie in a very simplistic way, and reading this, you just get this, you know, impact of just complete immersion in a pure, imaginative, wonderful, real world that just gives you thematic rich and depth from a Christian point of view that is just unparalleled, really. from today's perspective. And so I'd even say it's better than Scarlet Letter in terms of that as well. I mean, it's not that Scarlet Letter is like, you know, highly regarded among people who have to read it, but it is like extremely well done. And so for those of you, it's set in medieval Norway. And so obviously that means it's before the Reformation, it is Catholic. And so for people who are Protestant, maybe listening to this, like myself, is that colored at all? I don't think so. I think that we can learn a lot from our Catholic brothers and sisters in Christ about these things and about the fact that guilt and shame and sin are real and they need to be forgiven. And I also think this book is just wonderful for opening up questions. Like, as a Protestant, do I believe that certain Catholic conceptions of Christ's mediation, of forgiveness, do you think that there are unnecessary accoutrements or accretions upon the way that we receive mercy from God? I do think that. But at the same time, I think this book opens up questions to the nature of forgiveness, the nature of God's grace, the nature of human role in seeking forgiveness, of a contrite heart, of a humble spirit. And so I think that while it is medieval and Catholic, it's part of the historical fiction. It makes it pop more. But there are sincere Christians and believers here who have good, wise, true advice. I think that we can have responsible conversations about the nature of that and about the conflicts there. And you can actually listen to the second episode that Classical Stuff You Should Know did about this book, because they talked a lot about that. And the first one was kind of a summary of the first book, and the second podcast they did was a summary of like the first half of the second book, or first third of the second book, and with a big discussion about grace and forgiveness, things like that. So you can listen to that for a more detailed discussion. But anyway, this is a book of Christian imagination that is purely wonderful, transformative, and also rich and wise in Christian content. And we just long for real good Christian authors to just write things like this that are like just apparent and explicit about Christian faith, but also are wise and willing to be nuanced and get thematically rich and deep. So there's that. Second thought, it is just completely transportive. And anybody who, you know, you can read about, who has reviewed this book will say this. It is just transportive. It is immersive. The world she builds is so real and so true, because this really happened. Like, this is a, well, not really happened, but this was a real place. Medieval Norway is a real place that is thoroughly researched and thoroughly constructed here in this book. And so Tolkien is, you know, lauded for creating a complete fantasy world. Well, this almost feels like a fantasy world, except it like really existed. And so you can kind of feel the conflict, like I said, between the paganism of the old Scandinavia and the Catholicism that has taken root, and just the conflict of things that are just taken for granted, like the fact that spirits exist. Like, you can do dark magic to do things, and that people are ostracized because they are thought to be in contact with that kind of thing, you know? And the fact that Kristen, in the first chapter, when she's 7 years old, sees an elf maiden or a dwarf maiden, and the fact that it's just accepted as she saw that. That's true. That's what happened. And there's no conflict. And it's wonderful to just be reminded of the enchantment of the medieval imagination, and also of just the conflict, the clear-cut conflict between the Christianity, which has taken over and transforming society, and the lingering paganism that's there. But it's completely transportive, immersive, a piece of world-building that's really unmatched. Okay, third thought. It is relationally wise, okay? Many people have said, especially from, if you are, you know, a male, that this is a complete and total picture of what it means to be a woman. I think that's true. I have not read really another book that has informed me about what it is like to be a woman than this book. And so guys, you know, take notes. It is just a complete psychologically rich picture and portrait of what being a woman is like. In Close Reads, David Kern, the host of that, can make this very clear. Just, it is psychologically rich. The characters are real. They make choices which are understandable from their motives. And especially from Christian's point of view, it is just a complete joy to be able to see into a character who is just so much, just like a real character. And you can engage with that and understand things about the world because of stories. This book is what stories should be. It's about telling the truth about the world. It's about showing you characters that you can examine your own life. And it's about revealing to you things that you didn't know before. And so all of that is found here, especially when it comes to relationships. Another note, you might see this book promoted nowadays as more of a feminist thing. And in fact, the translator's note, which is really weird, because the last line of the translator's note was something like, "Now enjoy this story about a girl who defies everyone in pursuit of what she loves." And I'm like, did you translate the whole thing? Like, did we read the same book? Because she does that, yes, and there are consequences. And the book isn't totally for her just casting off everything for love. And so it really just mind-boggling to me that people can read this book and come away thinking that it is just feminist through and through. It is not. It holds Kristen to account for what she did. although it does place, you know, a due amount of blame upon Erland, who deceives her or seduces her. And so it condemns him 100%. But also it understands that, like, casting off all your familiar obligations, casting off, you know, all the duties you have to your relationships, aren't good things, because pursuing love isn't the highest, you know, your desires for love aren't the highest thing in the world. You have other things to do. You have your duties as well. And so to say that it's feminist is just completely to lie about what this book is. And honestly, like, just for some reason, people cannot just stop reading into old books, modern, secular, social justice, you name it. They read it back into old books. They read into Jane Austen feminism when it's not there. They read into Booker T. Washington, Frederick Douglass. They read into them SJW, BLM themes. They're not there. To stop reading into old books, modern themes. This book is not feminist. It is a complete wonderful picture of what it means to be a woman, of what true consequences of pursuing love looks like, or pursuing desire over duty looks like occasionally. And as such, it's going to be true and real and raw, but it has a moral framework, and it is wise. And so please do not say that it's feminist, because it's not. And you just read the translator's introduction and then read the book and see if they match up, because they don't. Kristen does do the things that the translator said she does. She does, you know, reject her family in favor of this love that she has. And her whole life is just dealing with the guilt and shame, forgiveness, with the hardness of that life. But it's just real and raw when it comes to understanding relationships as well, and just the further unfolding of that. What does her relationship with Seaman look like? What does her relationship with her parents look like? With her old priest? Just all of these things conflict because of what she wants and what she desires. And it is just wise in terms of how it depicts those, and how we interact with those things, and how we can just have a full picture of the consequences of doing certain things and the realness of trying to reconcile that with our family. So anyway, it's relationally wise. Just a couple other final just thoughts here. It's a page turner. At some points, it's a keep your earbud in your ear kind of story. You just keep listening to it, keep reading it, because it's that good. And I want to push against the stereotype that only modern books are page turners. That's not true. This one can get you turning those pages, get you cranking up those audible hours. It is really, really fascinating and fun to read and at all points, especially, like I said, if you get an easier translation. Another thought is it's complex. I mentioned Fireproof earlier. A lot of modern Christian art is just characterized as being too simple, and that's true. This is a thematically rich and complex book. It rewards discussion. It rewards contemplation. And as such, it's not going to give a simple, easy message. It's not just it has a good message, but it's not just that. And we talked about Love at Lasts a couple weeks ago, the book that we read that kind of basically makes the idea that we need to love things in art which lasts, because that's good for our souls, and reject things which aren't good, true, beautiful, and which have no connection to things which will last. They're just culturally just there and gone the next day. And one of the things that Joshua Gibbs, the author, says in that book is that a lot of modern ways of Christians interacting with art is just a worldview. You know, do they have a good message, a good worldview? Okay, bad art, good art. This has a good worldview. It does. It really does. It's a thoroughly Christian medieval imagination, which is something I think that we need more of in today's world. But at the same time, it is complex, and it's not just a simple piece of art you can reject or dismiss based upon one or two propositions. And it rewards discussion. So I think that it is definitely an uncommon piece of art that deserves discussion and contemplation. Okay, final thought. It proposes questions to you within a moral framework. So when Kristen and Erland commit sin together, it asks you, you know, is this a good thing? But it has a moral framework as it does these things. It asks you honest questions about decisions that characters make while having a moral framework it operates under that condemns certain things implicitly, that says that's wrong, that you can still operate in. And so Close Reads pointed this out as well. The conflict of duty and desire. You know, it's not just like duty is good and desire is bad. There is a, you know, nuanced conflict there. And so we have to understand that we can ask questions about the things characters make, decisions characters make, while also understanding that there is a right and wrong, that there's a moral framework. We can have these discussions and debates about that. And so I think this is a very good example of not being moralistic, asking questions, but still being moral. So that's what's my final thought about that. Is I think something that Christian art needs to do today as well is be able to ask questions within a strong Christian moral framework. Any critiques I have? So my one critique is really that occasionally it can drag in the melodramatic parts. So my reference, it took me a while to listen to it. It's pretty long. But also, in between the just page-turning parts, there are some times where, you know, Kristen just trying to reckon with her guilt and her grief and her shame and with her relationship. It just can kind of drag a little bit and go on for long periods of time. And that gets kind of boring. But besides that, the highs of this book are high. The page-turning stuff is really, really good. And so that's my main critique. But it just overcomes that critique with all the highs and the climaxes and the wonderful stuff. So, in conclusion, Christian Lavrin's Daughter is a wonderful piece of Christian imagination. Thoroughly wise. Thoroughly understands women, thankfully, because I don't. It understands relationships. It's transportive, immersive. The page-turner is complex. It rewards thought. It asks questions. And above all, should be imitated more by Christians today seeking to replicate art. So that's kind of my thesis. All right. Well, thank you for listening to that. Hope that was beneficial and edifying for you. I'm going to do some donor shout-outs now. If you would like a donor shout-out on our show, you should go to patreon.com/bookinit. Support us at $5 or more a month. We get you a shout-out here on the show. So thank you to our patrons, Nana, Van Pappy and Wayla, Mike and Sylvia, Moses and Zara, Aunt Jenny and Uncle Sam, Mr. Mike, Miss Laura, Anna, Emily, Keenan, Will, my mom, Mrs. Hall, and Kara. Thank you so much for your support. And like I said, you can check us out at patreon.com/bookinit. You can check out our website at 412podcasting.com. Subscribe to our newsletter there. A lot of fun stuff going on. Also, we've been talking about just the future of the podcast as we're all graduating. The plan is to continue the podcast, but what that looks like is still kind of being hashed out. So I could ask for patience with that and prayer as we think about what to do next for the podcast. But we have really enjoyed doing this. We want to keep doing it, and we want to give good content to you guys. So thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed that. Feel free to contact us with questions, with a discussion you want to have, anything like that. We always enjoy hearing from you guys. But until next time, keep on booking it.